This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Duke Professor Bob Korstad wants history to be told by those who lived it. He's collected oral histories from textile workers, recorded the stories of civil rights activism, but what he really wanted were stories of life before the civil rights movement. He wanted to hear from African Americans who lived in a time when lynching was still common and the Ku Klux Klan was a powerful fact of life. By 1994, he and his colleagues had collected more than 1,300 oral histories of people living in the Jim Crow South. This project at Duke Center for Documentary Studies was called Behind the Veil, Documenting African-American Life in the Jim Crow South. And those stories are now being digitized and put online. The first 100 have already been completed. There are more to come. Bob Korstad is here with us today, a professor of public policy and history at Duke University. Welcome back.
Thanks, Lee.
Always a pleasure to have you.
Always nice to be here.
So tell us about this project. How did it get started? What was behind it?
Well, in the late 1980s, at about the same time the Center for Documentary Studies was getting started, I was talking with my colleagues Bill Chafe and Ray Gavins, and we had all been writing about the civil rights movement, the labor movement in the South. We'd used oral history fairly extensively, and we were thinking of, and most of the work that had been done in African American history was focused on the civil rights movement or slavery. And we started thinking about this period, this large period actually, before the civil rights movement and after Reconstruction. And we realized that there was actually very little oral history done on this period of time. People saw it as a static time, the kind of solid South, that nothing really changed. It wasn't a very dynamic time. And so historians, particularly oral historians, hadn't been that concerned about it. And we set out to rectify that.
What kind of stories did you hear?
Well, we heard all kinds of stories. We went all over the South. We went in large towns, small towns, industrial towns, rural towns. We used a life history format in which we basically had people narrate their lives. So we heard stories that they had been told about slavery time. So we were able to go back two, three, four generations in many cases to capture memories that had been passed down. We actually heard a much richer and more complex story about black life in the South than we had anticipated.
Some of it, of course, were stories that we might expect, stories about family members being lynched, being chased off of farms, Ku Klux Klan terrorism. But I guess there's also the stories of that kind of organization that was going on in the churches, the below-the-radar kind of organization that led to the civil rights movement.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's really the story behind the veil that most whites didn't understand or appreciate, and that was the creation of families and communities, of autonomous institutions, the churches, the schools, social clubs, social organization. It's really very amazing when you go back and look at some of the newspapers that covered some of these things in that period of time, just to see how busy and in some ways engaged people in these African American communities were.
One thing some historians worry about when you use oral history to tell a story is that the people making the history at the time don't know they're making history. And it's hard for them, in some cases, to articulate their role in all of this. It takes a little bit of perspective. How do you balance those things?
Well, it's not an easy thing. I mean, I think that you try to get people to remember and to narrate important moments in their lives. You try to get them to remember people who were special to them or events that took place that they remember that made some kind of change. And then we do a lot of research before we go into these communities, studying the things that went on. And so in some cases, we would ask people, you know, what impact did a depression make on you? Or do you remember World War II or other important events?
How did you find the people you interviewed?
Well, we had a team of graduate students and graduate assistants who went out. We chose communities based on work cultures. So we tried to look around the South for different types of work that people did, industrial labor, domestic labor, farm labor. And we would identify towns that represented that. And then our staff would go, and they would go to churches, senior citizen centers, community centers were places where you could meet people, and we would we would start really getting into a network of people and interviewing that way. It was not hard to find people. In fact, I think one of the most interesting things for us was that how ready people were to talk about that period of time, which in many cases to tell stories that no one had ever heard before.
Were they surprised you were even interested?
I think they were. I think they were, they would say, well, why do you want to talk to me? I'm not famous. I didn't do anything. And we, you know, explained the point of this. And in fact, their lives were an important part of that history. And I think the thing that that really got to many people was, you know, this period of time in African American history has not been documented and has not been told about. And if you don't help us do this, this is going to be lost forever.
Now, when you say that, we know about this period. It has been documented. We know about the Jim Crow South.
Yes, but I don't think the kind of stories of everyday life have been told in the kind of detail that we can now.
Right, so it's been kind of a top-down. We're looking at leadership, we're looking at movements, but who is in office?
Right.
But we don't really hear it from the ground. And we have several examples. Obviously, we've got 100 of them digitized and more to come of the 1,300 that you collected. First one we're going to listen to is Mayor Maurice Lucas of Renova, Mississippi, and he's talking about lynchings.
Oh, man, they hung black folk for stealing white folk cow and everything else. Whatever white folks designed, because they tried. My uncle must have been in the 40s. They went to Chicago and got Uncle Jim. Uncle Jim killed a man right out here from Renova. But this old white lady that owned the plantation, she went to court with Uncle Jim. The judge said, hang him or let him go free. That white woman stood up and said, don't you hang Jim. That's my good nigga. They let Uncle Jim go free. That's the damn truth. Man, he white folk do their thing, man.
There's Mayor Maurice Lucas of Renova, Mississippi, recorded in 1995. What do you find interesting in that clip?
Well, it actually tells a lot about a lot of different things. One of the things it tells about is just the power that whites had to decide life and death in these circumstances. If that, the contrast between people being lynched for, you know, looking at someone the wrong way. And here is a man who sounds like it actually killed someone, but he was a loyal employee and a necessary employee for somebody on the plantation. So he goes free. So the kind of arbitrariness and the capriciousness of the system of Jim Crow really comes across in these interviews.
And I think to the astute listener, and this is one of the things that oral histories can do that no other kind of history can, he's laughing. He's telling that story in a way. First of all, he could be more or less glosses. Yeah, he killed this guy. And then, so if I were to write, if I read that story, I'd think, oh, what a horror. But hearing him, I have an insight into how people coped with that as well. And that's the insight I couldn't get from the text account of that story.
That's absolutely right. And that's why we've digitized these. They're online at Duke. You can look at the transcripts. You can listen to them. They're at the David Rubenstein Manuscript and Rare Book Collection at Duke. And I think you're right. It's a different kind of window into the past.
Now, you had grad students collecting these histories. What effect did that have on them to actually meet people who lived this?
Well, I think it was transforming for many of these students. We had African-American graduate students and white graduate students, Latino graduate students, and we had them from all over the country. Most had some kind of background in this history, but I think they were really moved both by the stories and the honesty of the people that they interviewed and by the willingness of people to share their lives. Virtually all of these students have, went on to dissertations and have written books, prize-winning books, many of them based on these interviews and the experiences they had.
Did it change your perspective on things, and how does it change their ideas about what was happening?
Well, it certainly changed mine. I think that I have a much better understanding about, the different ways in which Jim Crow manifests itself in the South.
We have another clip that I want to hear. This one is from 1994. The interview was done in 1994. The man's name is John Harrison Volter. He's from New Iberia, Louisiana. And in this clip, he's talking about the Ku Klux Klan. Let's listen.
On my views, they may be contrary to what other people believe are the Ku Klux Klan, per se, were not set up by the lower class of Caucasians. The lower class of Caucasians were recruited into the Ku Klux Klan by former rich plantation owners who saw a way to gain some of their property back. And they used prejudice ideas, class ideas, on these ignorant, low-class Caucasians, you know. The act of giving each free slave so many acres of land, and then the Ku Klux Klan scared them off it, you know. You see, these poor whites that was the body of the Klan didn't gain nothing. Because the land went back to the rich owner, you know, it didn't go to them. But it's just showing you how man manipulated, you know, their own people.
That's a 1994 interview with John Harrison Volter of Louisiana talking about the KKK. Bob Korstad, what do you take from that piece of data?
Well, it's a wonderful historical insight that historians took them a long time to kind of figure out, and some have been some great pieces of Southern scholarship based on that single idea. And, you know, what was interesting in his interview and in a lot of others was just how well people had already thought and understood the complexities in this, of the society that they lived in. I mean, this man understood the way in which race was used to keep poor blacks and poor whites apart, and that the people at the top were the ones who really benefited. I mean, I think that's an insight that's very important to be thinking about today. So
I was going to say, thank God it's a historical insight and nothing like that is going on
right,
today.
Exactly.
Because that would be a horror if it were happening today. But
right.
Luckily, it's all in the past. This project is important. Now we're digitizing. Why digitize it now?
Well, I think it makes it available to the general public. I mean, scholars have been using this ever since we put it in the library. But I think it's important for the general public to go on to listen to these voices. I think for one thing, you know, one of the things I found is that a lot of these people had not shared these stories about the Jim Crow era, particularly the horrors of it, with their children, you know, who grew up really after the Civil Rights Movement. They wanted to protect themselves. So a lot of the children of the people we interviewed haven't heard these stories, never heard these stories from their parents and grandparents. And so I think there's an opportunity for all Americans to understand, you know, just how the remnants of that time still linger in the social environment that we live in.
Did you have to take into account the racial dynamics of the interview itself, the fact that a black person might be talking to a white person and the way this story would be rendered in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, we always, you know, were attentive to that. And there were some people who, some African-Americans who wouldn't talk to white students that were in communities. But in other cases, there were people who were much more open with white students than they were with the black students. And a lot of it was just, you know, the personalities. We tried to pick people who were good listeners as our interviewers and the researchers on the project.
What was the biggest surprise for you in going through all this tape?
Well, I think one of the things was just the records or the kind of stories of resistance and the very unique ways that people use to get around the whole structure of Jim Crow, the tactics they use, the kind of counter psychology on people, stories of people using whatever economic independence or economic power they had to get things from white shop owners or other people. So I think that the level of both of resistance in these communities was really interesting to hear about.
What you can do too, and what's interesting to me is the way you can piece together as you talk about these strategies and tactics in resistance, and understand that what looked like an entirely hopeless situation, 1943, could you predict the end of Jim Crow? 1960, would you predict the end of Jim Crow? All of these little strategies adding up and actually count for something. It's very instructive when you're facing tall odds to understand that these things can be accomplished in very small and ingenious ways.
Right. Yeah. The civil rights movement came from someplace, and it came from periods of social learning in which people tried this organizational style or they tried this form of resistance. So, without all of that, the civil rights movement wasn't combustion or just this kind of spontaneous thing. It was built on years of fighting back at this system.
So when is the project going to be fully digitized?
Well, the librarians are working very hard, and I think the resources are an issue. But I hope in the next few years we'll have the vast majority of these online and for people to listen to and look at the transcripts. We've got thousands of photographs that we took cameras and recorded photo albums of individual families, and that's one of the next things that we'll try to start getting ready to digitize.
So we can hear these online, and you say we can see them at the Duke Library? Where?
Right, at the David Rubenstein Manuscript and Rare Book Collection.
Great. Bob, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Frank.
Bob Korstad, professor of public policy and history at Duke University, co-director of the Documentary Research Project at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. And this was called Behind the Veil, Documenting African-American Life in the Jim Crow South. You can hear the stories yourself at library.duke.edu. That's the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. Our website is stateofthings.org, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.